Test 1. You will hear a number of different recordings, and you have to answer questions on what you hear. There'll be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you have a chance to check your work. All the recordings will be played only once. The test is in 4 sections. At the end of the test, you will be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to your answer sheet. Now turn to Section 1. Section 1. You will hear a conversation between a salesman and a customer. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 10. Now listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 10. Good afternoon, madam. How may I help you?
Good afternoon. I'd like to ship some possessions to Canada and was hoping you could answer a few of my questions.
Certainly. Please take a seat. Where exactly are you going to ship the goods?
To Toronto. I'm taking a job there at the end of next month.
Right. We can ship your possessions by air or by sea and land. Shipping by air is faster, but is obviously more expensive.
I understand. That's what I expected. If I want the things there by the 25th of next month, do I still have time to send them by sea?
I'll just check the schedules. Yes, if your possessions start their journey by the 26th of this month at the latest, they'll be in Toronto by the 25th of next month. However, I would recommend that you send them earlier if possible, because there are sometimes delays due to logistics or weather conditions.
Yes, of course. I was thinking of sending them on the 20th or thereabouts.
That's great. There's a cargo ship leaving on the 21st. Would it be possible to send your possessions on the 19th? It can take 2 days to get the items to the port and to clear customs at this end.
Yes, I guess that would be okay.
In that case, your possessions should arrive on or around the 19th of next month. Though, as I said, there are sometimes delays. Is that okay for you?
That's perfect. That's the very day I arrive in Canada. It could be a bit hectic, though. Anyway, I won't need my things immediately, so a short delay won't cause any problems.
Don't worry. You won't be able to take delivery of your possessions that day because of customs checks. Those usually take a couple of days. Will you be packing everything yourself, or would you like us to take care of that for you?
I'd prefer to have your employees do it. As you can imagine, I'm rather busy at the moment.
And you'll want us to arrange delivery to your new home in Canada, rather than leaving the items at the warehouse in Toronto, right?
Yes, please. I know that door-to-door delivery costs more, but it's so much more convenient.
Okay, then. Here's a price list. The prices include tax and insurance. As you can see, the price depends mainly on the dimensions of the crates and the number of crates rather than their weight. However, we do add an extra charge for particularly heavy items. Do you intend to ship any furniture?
No, nothing like that. Just books, clothes, a few small electrical items and a few ornaments.
If there are any fragile items, such as glass ornaments, I can make a note for our packers. There's no extra charge for such items.
Thank you. There is a little glassware. Using plenty of bubble wrap should ensure it arrives intact. Would you recommend 3 of the smaller sized crates or one of the very large ones?
For ease of handling, we normally suggest that customers use the smaller sized ones. The large ones appear cheaper, but if they exceed a certain weight, they incur an extra charge. We generally only use them for large, lightweight items or furniture.
I see. I think that 3 of the smaller crates measuring 2 cubic meters should do the trick.
Okay. In that case, the total price will be £360. Is that okay?
Yes, that's fine. Thank you. Can I pay by credit card? I have Master Express.
Of course. I need to take down a few details. Could I take your name, please?
My given name is Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, and my surname is Wheeling, W-H-E-A-L-I-N-G.
And your address?
14 Hopton Close. The postcode is PT6-2JA.
And the address where we should ship your possession to in Canada?
42A Lakeview Road, in the district of Victoria.
Is Lakeview written as one word or two?
Two. The postcode is TR123CN.
Do you have a mobile phone?
I do. The number's 0977-023-685.
Thank you. Right then, our packers will arrive on the morning of the 19th. I'm afraid I can't give you an exact time, but it should be around 10 o'clock, depending on the traffic.
Thank you. As long as they finish before 1 o'clock, I don't mind.
I'll make a note of that. Right, I'll just deal with the payment. That is the end of section 1. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 2. Section 2. You will hear a presentation on the places you can visit in the locality of the university. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 20. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 20.
Good morning, everyone. I am very happy to be here to give you a brief introduction to some of the places you can visit in the locality of your university. I hope that you can take some time out from your studies to pay a visit to at least a few of them. First, I'd like to tell you about Dinosaur Isle and Fossil Walk. It's one of my favourite days out. I remember my first visit there. We were walking along a beautiful sandy beach when our paleontologist guide stops suddenly and points at a rock, perhaps 60 centimetres across. That, he says, is the cast of a dinosaur's footprint. At first I thought he was joking, but he goes on to point out the three vast toes and to explain that this stone was moulded in the footprint of an iguanodon some 125 million years ago. From the size of the foot, he adds, this particular herbivorous biped would have been about 8 metres long and perhaps 2.5 metres tall to the hip. This area is one of the most prolific and accessible sites in Europe for dinosaur fossils. Bits of bone are regularly found on the beaches, and the Dinosaur Isle Museum has a collection of international importance, and is thoroughly family-friendly to boot. At the museum, you can walk back in time, via the Last Ice Age, and the Eocene, to the late Cretaceous, to the heyday of the dinosaurs, to which the main hall is dedicated. The information is accessibly presented, and there is enough to satisfy even the most ardent dinophile of any age. The collection sensibly majors on the dinosaurs that once roamed this area, with full-sized reconstructions, as well as fossils, ranging from huge vertebrae to toothed jaws and long leg bones. Many of the specimens were found by amateur fossil hunters, including two families on holiday here in the 1970s, who found some bones on a beach in the southwest of the island. they turned out to belong to an iguanodon. And another completely new dinosaur, subsequently called Neovenator, meaning new hunter. On my first fossil walk, a piece of dinosaur rib bone was found, and the day before, four dinosaur bones were discovered, as well as a large prehistoric crocodile tooth. Even if you're not lucky enough to find bits of dinosaur, there are 110 million-year-old shells and fossilized wood to be collected. Our guide was not only extremely knowledgeable, but also endlessly patient, as he identified a steady stream of sandstone and flint with a few fossils thrown in. Back at the museum, there is stacks for kids to do. Three different activity sheets and lots of interactive exhibits. The touchy-feely game was a big hit. It revealed a sauropod claw, fossilized dinosaur poo. It's great fun for the kids to make their parents feel this. And then there is the cast of a Tyrannosaurus's brain, which is remarkable for its smallness. Smells from the dinosaur's world were much enjoyed too. Rotting corpse, pine forest, swamp, and carnivore breath. The last was particularly yucky in my opinion. An interactive map shows where the locality's five main dinosaurs were found, along with a second map indicating their global spread. Upstairs, there is a reconstruction of the Sandown pterosaur, which was unearthed close to the museum, and its fossils, along with information about the area's own Tyrannosaurus, discovered in 1995, about half the size of T-Rex and called Eotyrannus lengi, as well as loads of dinosaur-related art activities. Unfortunately, there are currently no refreshments available on site, but there is a mini golf course next to the museum, which has a cafe. The museum is fully wheelchair accessible. Let me just give you the admission details. Dinosaur Isle and Fossil Walk are both open daily 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. April to October, and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. November to March. Adult tickets are £4.75. Children under 15 pay £2.75. There's also a family ticket available for two adults and two children, which costs £13. Students and retirees pay £3.75. The two-hour guided dinosaur walk is included in the ticket price. Finally, I'll let you know how to get there. Despite the name, Dinosaur Isle isn't actually an island. From the university, take bus number 30, which I believe stops right outside the main gate. Is that right? Yes. Thank you. The bus stops almost directly in front of the museum, and you can't miss that because it has a big plastic T-Rex outside. If you're going as a group of more than 8, please telephone in advance. A group discount is available if you do, but not if you arrive unannounced. The phone number is 019-40434, and there's a website too, www.sandowndinosaur.com.
That is the end of section 2. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 3. Section 3. You will hear a talk. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 30. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 30. Welcome to our university radio program entitled Leaping the Language Barrier. My guests today are Tony Wu, a master's student from China, Susan Hall, international student liaison, and Wendy Clark, head of the ESL unit here at the university. Tony, you're starting your master's degree in a few weeks, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'll be taking a master's in computing. Like many overseas students, I found the selection process tough. Making the transition from undergraduate studies to postgraduate research is hard enough for a native speaker. But my lack of fluency in English was a bigger hurdle, so I decided to take a pre-master's course. Susan, are these courses popular?
Not at the moment, but each year over 100,000 overseas students apply to study for a postgraduate degree in this country. Many of these students, like Tony, need to work on their English to get the maximum benefit from their time here. Paying full fees, these students represent a significant source of income for the universities. As a result, a growing number of universities and private colleges are offering foundation or pre-master's courses. The pre-master's courses are designed to bridge the gap between undergraduate studies and a postgraduate degree taught in English.
That's right. I won my place on the master's course after attending a 9-month pre-master's program at the International Foundation College, a private language and study skills school approved by universities in this country. Wendy, you're an ESL professional. How useful are these courses?
Very useful indeed. As Susan said, many students come here with some English, but not really enough to take full advantage of having an education in an English-speaking country. Pre-master's courses bring language proficiency up to a more acceptable level. Students develop language skills through classroom interaction and by being part of the wider community, living among native English speakers.
Tony, how successful were the other students on your course? The IFC pre-master's course started in January with 28 students, all from China. All but 5 gained places on university master's courses. The IFC was very happy with the success rate. Wendy, Tony didn't do his course here, but this university does have a pre-master's course, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. In this country, at least a dozen universities now run courses specially designed to cater for the needs of students from overseas regions, particularly Russia, Japan, China, East and South Asia. On top of that, private colleges are starting to enter the market, although most stick to what they do best, improving students' English language test scores. Last year, we prepared 80 foreign students, mostly from China, Southeast Asia, Iran, and the former Soviet republics, for master's degrees at universities in this country. Studied over an academic year, the course is demanding. Students from a range of disciplines are taught by a subject specialist, with an English language teacher working alongside to review students' comprehension and written work. The course culminates in a mini dissertation prepared over 4 months.
Did you find that difficult, Tony?
I certainly did.
I believe that a pre-master's course should do a lot more than boost language skills. It's also about preparing students from different cultural backgrounds to succeed in the academic world. We prepare them to look at a variety of sources, analyse the pros and cons, put forward their own ideas, challenge their tutors, and take part in rigorous discussion.
Wendy, has the course run at this university been successful?
The results here speak for themselves. The 1-year pre-master's program has a 90% success rate, and a smattering of students go on to Harvard, Yale, Oxford, and Cambridge, as well as other prestigious institutions. However, at $9,000, the course fee is on a par with the full fee for a master's program itself.
Susan, do you have any reservations about these programs?
Not here at our university, but I am unhappy at what I see as a lack of control over the proliferation of pre-master's programs. Some form of external validation is needed, as there is no universal recognition of the quality of such courses. There is a benchmark system for access to higher education courses for domestic students, but so far there is no nationwide benchmark for foundation courses for international students.
Thank you all very much. Next week I'll be talking to... That is the end of Section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4. Section 4. You will hear a monologue on the subject of an amazing discovery. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40. Welcome, everybody. My name is Derek Fisher, and I'll be taking you through this talk on a truly amazing discovery made by my team of researchers last year. As I'm sure you know, we discovered Tiktaalik rosae, a so-called missing link in the evolutionary process, a fish that walked on land. We made this extraordinary discovery in the Canadian Arctic. I should emphasize right at the beginning that I do not have any evidence to suggest that this was the only such fish to make the leap from the sea to the land. I think that further discoveries may await researchers. Anyway, the fossil discovery illuminates a chapter in the history of life on Earth that was essential to the ultimate emergence of human beings. This is an impression of Tiktaalik rosae, which, we believe, lived about 375 million years ago. As you can see, it has features that blur the distinction between fish and terrestrial-limbed creatures. The fossils that we found on Ellesmere Island, 600 miles from the North Pole, are a fine example of evolution in action. They have allowed us to freeze-frame a process of adaption to land that took tens of millions of years, and which made possible the development of all the mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians that have existed since. Without creatures such as Tiktaalik, there would have been no dinosaurs, no primitive mammals, and none of the hominids such as Australopithecus africanus and Homo erectus that started the human family tree. This animal represents the transition from water to land, the part of history that includes ourselves. It's as much a part of our history as, say, Australopithecus africanus. Now you can see those teeth. From that, it is clear to us that Tiktaalik rosae was a predator with sharp teeth and a head shaped like a crocodile's that grew to between 4 feet and 9 feet. That's between 1.2 metres and 2.7 metres long, for those of you using the metric system. We named it after consultation with elders from the Inuit people, who are native to the region, who suggested their word for large shallow water fish. The second part of the name honours the person who funded our research, but wishes remain anonymous.
It had several remarkable anatomical features that show it was capable not only of wading in shallow water, like slightly earlier fish on the cusp of the move to land, but also of supporting itself outside the water in the manner of four-limbed animals, or tetrapods. This is where Tiktaalik truly blurs the boundary between fish and land animals. This animal is both fish and tetrapod. At first, we jokingly called it a fishapod. Unlike fish, it had a clearly defined neck and a strong ribcage that would have enabled it to stand outside water. Its pectoral fins had a wrist joint, which enabled it to crawl on the ground. This wrist is sufficiently similar to that of later animals, including human beings, to suggest that Tiktaalik or something very like it was an ancestor of all subsequent land animals. However, we cannot be sure of that. When we talk about the fish's wrist, we're talking about the origin of parts of our own wrist. It is absolutely clear from Tiktaalik's skeleton that it could support itself in shallow water or on land. This is why it represents a critical early phase in the evolution of all limbed animals, including humans. We found the Tiktaalik fossils in 2004 after a 5-year search of a rock formation on Ellesmere Island, one of the large islands that comprise the north of Canada. This site was chosen because it was, or more exactly the rocks were, laid down during the late Devonian period, between 380 million and 365 million years ago, when the transition of fish from sea creatures to creatures that could survive on land is known to have taken place. It may surprise you to know that although the rocks are now within the Arctic Circle, in the late Devonian they lay close to the equator. We, as individual humans, don't notice plate movements because dramatic changes can only be seen over millions of years. But the continents as we know them today have moved considerably and will continue to do so. This exciting discovery is providing a much deeper understanding of this evolutionary milestone. Previous fossils representing this evolutionary event have really been fish with a few land characteristics, or land vertebrates with a few residual fish characteristics. These fossils show an animal that sits bang in the middle. Now, let's move on to... That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test, the IELTS test. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the listening answer sheet.